Okay, this is a very deep question. Dear Ajahn, how many light bulbs does it take to change a limiter? There's a reason why some of them get lost. I'm not quite sure why that one never got lost. Dear Ajahn, can we visit your cave? Yes, you can visit the cave. Not this time, though. Not tonight. There are visiting times. Like anyone else, any other place you go to, there are visiting times. You've got to be very careful. Because visiting the cave, caves can be very spooky if you go in them at the wrong time. But yeah, sometimes people want to visit that cave. That'll probably be towards the end of the retreat one day. How many of you have visited that cave? Most of you have done it already. I've visited it. I don't know why people want to go and visit a cave. Isn't that, I'm maybe the only person, or certainly the only monk, who allows his bedroom to be visited. It's weird. But as long as I'm not in it. Dear Ajahn, what do you mean when you say focus on the causes instead of, like, example, wanting to get the nimitta? What are the causes? I've been teaching all these days and you haven't recognized what the causes are now. Be content and easily satisfied. Be peaceful. Sit down there, close your eyes, shut up, and see what happens. The causes of the nimittas. You put the water down and it becomes still all by itself. You, even the first day, remember I told a simile of the donkey and the durian or the cow, whatever it is, and you go running after it, and that's what most people do all the retreat, and then you stop and it comes towards you. That's the cause. Not doing anything. And giving your mind time to relax and be peaceful. Honestly, that sometimes, you know, because it's not, you're not used to being simple because you're always doing stuff, sometimes it goes against the grain. But when you are still, when you don't do anything, you leave things alone, let them be, don't attach, make peace, be kind, be gentle, you find your mind settles down. It gets nice and peaceful, easy to watch the breathing, just comes in and goes out, all by itself. You don't do anything. You don't want anything in the whole world. Remember, wanting was the wind which makes the leaf vibrate. Don't want anything, just be still. And the hindrances, they usually just disappear by themselves. Give them time. Basically, there's no place for them to run to here. As long as you keep off your telephones or computers, what can you do with hindrances over here? There's no sort of nightclub, there's no TVs, there's nothing to do. The only thing to think about here is what type of tea you want, black tea or green tea. Nothing much to think about. So after a while, just all that disappears. It's got no place to grow. And so after a while, it gets peaceful and still. And then the mind becomes very mindful and everything starts to look brighter and happy all by itself, and it surprises you because you don't do anything. You sit in front of the dining room and just have a cup of tea and watch the trees grow, and then everything becomes, because you're resting, you get energized. Your battery is flat most of the day, but when you come here, the battery is an opportunity to recharge. When it does, wow, this place looks really beautiful. If you're enjoying the scenery of this place, the food in this place, enjoying your room, enjoying this, some of the city jokes you've heard 1,000 times, that actually shows you your ability to see happiness is increasing. That means that, you know, you're being more aware. When you become more aware, then of course it's very easy just to watch the breath and just leave it alone. Okay, breath, you do what you want, I'm just watching, just hanging out with you. And then the breath gets so still. it disappears. Sometimes I haven't mentioned this yet, but a good way of looking at what this meditation is, you have the six senses, the five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and the six senses, the mind. The mind doesn't get much attention because the five senses dominate you. And here the five senses have got very little place to play around in. So the five senses just get less and less and less. The mind gets more of the energy now from you, until that energy gets strong enough that whatever you are, say, watching your breath, it appears delightful. I never mention why. Why does the breath appear delightful when you're still? Why does that clump of bamboo I mentioned appear beautiful? Where does that come from? And anyone who has ever looked at the Anapanasati Sutta in Pali knows that even in that fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth stages of Anapanasati, what you're doing there, you're experiencing the citta sankhara. They ask you to stabilize and calm that citta sankhara. And that gives the information. This is coming from your mind. Instead of just feeling the breathing, you're knowing the breathing. You're experiencing it through a different sense door. Not through the sense of touch, but the sense of mind. And that becomes really beautiful. And that allows that fifth sense to shut off. You're actually not feeling the breath anymore. You're knowing it. You know, experiencing it through the sixth sense. And that's why it appears far more refined and far more beautiful. You're shutting down the five senses. And the sixth sense is now dominating from the delightful breath. Yeah, you've still got a little bit of sense awareness of the through the touch left, but very, very little. And once you get to the nimittas, that last part of the five senses is shut off. So you just really are experiencing the mind now. And that nimitta, I don't think I mentioned this, but I think some of you have read this and know I say this all the time. Everyone in this room, you will experience a nimitta sooner or later. If not now, when you're dead, floating out of your body, going towards the light. That is the same as the nimittas, which you experience when you're still alive. You just start calming down the five senses until they're not really active, and then this nimitta appears. Exactly the same thing. And you may have heard when people just really get into this nimitta, that it blisses out, even when you die. You've got something to look forward to. Anyway, this is what that nimitta is. And so you know the causes. Wanting it. Striving for it. Okay, so people say we don't want it, we just aspire towards it. It's the same thing, just different words. That's why sometimes you can change the words, but the meaning is the same. But you know, some words are a little bit more interesting. But anyway, it's still turning off the five senses. Once those five senses turn off, you've just got the mind. Then you can know what these five senses really are when they're gone. It's much more freedom. Once upon a time, there was this person, and they were in jail. And the jail had these five high walls. The five high walls were seeing, hearing, smelling, taste and touch. And they were so big, you couldn't get beyond them. And one day this prisoner, he was having a terrible time because the prison officer was always very cruel and harsh, always telling him what to do, making him do things. He didn't have much choice. And the prison officer's name was Will. And Will never let you alone. You thought you controlled your will. You did what you wanted to do, but you didn't do what you wanted to do. You did what the prison officer told you to do, but you thought it was you, but no. That's like, it's similar to that another story which I sometimes talk about in the Chinese Art of War, that general in the Imperial Army had the best discipline of all the generals, and the emperor wanted to find out his secret. And so he asked the general, "Now, why do your soldiers always follow orders?" And the general replied, "Because I only tell them to do what they want to do. That's why they always follow my orders." And of course, you know, when you read that, you think, well, this is much deeper than just... Because how can you tell the soldiers to go and fight in battle and sacrifice their limbs? They get up really in the morning and train hard and give up so much, you know. They were motivated, that's why. Their will had been conditioned. They were brainwashed. And I admit, I'm an honest monk. I spent the last 3 days brainwashing you. Ajahn Chah spent years brainwashing me. His teacher, Ajahn Mun, brainwashed him. All the way down the line, I brainwashed the nuns. Is that true? Come on, admit it. Yeah, okay, very good. She's smart. Sometimes you call it brainwashing or you call it inspiring them. Just showing just how easy it is to meditate. Is it easy to meditate? Is it hard to meditate? When I brainwash you and say it's easy, then it becomes easy. But this is profound stuff. And when I sort of brainwash you into not doing anything, just sitting down there and being mindful and kind, and caring, then you find it works. You couldn't do that by yourself. You need to be brainwashed. So, I ask another question of you. Who brainwashed the Buddha? I know that some of you know the answer, be quiet. It's no fun when somebody's heard it before and they put their hand up and they tell the right answer. Where did the Buddha get his inspiration from?
Nature.
Sorry?
Nature.
No. Nice try. Because the answer is that the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, who used to be a monk with Kassapa the Buddha. I don't know, it's said so in the suttas, in the Gatikara Sutta. I don't know why just people pass over that and don't sort of give it the importance which it deserves. Imagine Siddhartha Gautama. He was a monk named Jyotipala under Kassapa the Buddha. And it doesn't say what happened to the Buddha after he passed away, but if you were that amazing person, you're going to be a Buddha soon, and you were a monk under another Buddha, that must have given you some great wisdom. And that explains why, I know people think this is just superstition or whatever, just belief. They usually call it hagiography, where they take a teacher and they give him all sorts of psychic powers and all sorts of things which he never did. But according to the tradition, when the Buddha was born, he took 7 steps and he said, "This is my last life, I'm the chief in the world." How could he say that? We assume he did actually say it, then that would mean he had some incredibly powerful karma from the past. And of course, according to the tradition, the Buddha descended into this world from the Tusita heaven. There's another quote in the suttas where it said that once returners, Sakadagamis, for the most part, take rebirth in the Tusita realm before they come back into this realm and then become fully enlightened, arahats. Because they've only got one more birth, only once returned to this world. was Siddhartha Gautama when he was born a once returner? It's only, they don't say that, but it's circumstantial evidence, a lot of evidence that suggests that's possible. But anyway, you do need something from another Aryan, another enlightened being, to be able to see this Dhamma, and that must be where it's from. Why do you think a 6 or 7 year old boy sitting under a rose apple tree, just watching his father just plough the field, just got into a first jhana? That's weird. Unless he'd done that before. I'll let you... I'm not going to let you think about that. Just stop thinking about it. It's just a bit more brainwashing side. But anyway, the causes... Just let go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in Majjhima Nikaya number 30, the Buddha warned us about complacency. The holy life has to live to the fullest. How can I relax when the Buddha always works so hard? Is there a sutta where the Buddha was relaxing? Ajahn, yes, I mentioned that already. The Buddha was almost falling asleep, and Mara came and said, what are you doing? You're going to sleep during the middle of the day. And he said, I'm doing this for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. So when you go to sleep tonight, you know, what am I doing this for? You're doing this for the happiness and well-being of all sentient beings. So you can be healthy, so that you can be in a good mood when you go and see a person the next day, so you can be peaceful, so you can be happy, so you can be enlightened. You know that when the Buddha realized, he said this in the Mahasatchika Sutta, Majjhima 36, he said he tried all these other ways to find out the Dhamma. And then when he exhausted all his possibilities, that's when he remembered as a kid sitting under the rose apple tree and getting into a first jhana. And he said, why was I afraid? Or why am I afraid of that bliss of the jhanas? And he said, I will not be afraid of that bliss. Perhaps that's a path to Sambodhi, to enlightenment. And he realized, yes, it is a path to enlightenment. And so the next thing he did, he realized that it's not easy to get into those jhanas. It's not impossible, but it's not easy if your body is weak and tired. And so he decided to eat properly, to bathe, to rest. And just that change in his lifestyle was enough to make his first 5 friends, they later became the first 5 disciples, think that he'd given up the holy life. He was slacking off. Sometimes people ask me here, why do we have an air con in this room? Let's really just sort out the men from the boys. Let's have no air con, no seats, no cushions. We'll just have it cold, and those who are tough, they'll get through this. Let's not have all of this getting up if you like, if you don't like. Let's everyone get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. No, that's a bit late, 2 o'clock. And let's just sit here and no one moves. No breakfast. You can have a lunch, you've got to eat, but just in your bowl, just put everything in there, just stir it all up until it becomes a mush so you can eat that. This monk did that once over in Northumberland. It was a rule for the monastery. There's only about 4 or 5 monks in this monastery. So what was left over, from the dana the day before, he put it in a bucket, put it in the fridge, and in the morning they take it out. Any more food made in the monastery or cooked that day would go in the top, stirred all up, and he passed this mush down the line. He'd take what he wanted first and then pass to the next monk or the next monk, and that's all they ate. There was no waste. You know, you can take as much as you like or as little as you like, but it was always stirred up in the morning and take as much as you like, and what was left over, put in the fridge, added to the next day. Is that a good idea for Dhammasara, next rains retreat? At the end of the retreat, all the monks left except the abbot. But it looked tough, didn't it? Oh, those are real monks. But when the Buddha tried that, it didn't work. So that when he just decided just to follow the middle way, avoiding those two extremes of being too austere or too indulgent, his first five friends gave up on him. They thought he wasn't trying anymore. And then suddenly after he became enlightened and they saw him, that something about him had changed. And that's his first ever teaching, was the middle way. Avoid those extremes. Have a reasonably healthy body if you can. And then see if you can get into these jhanas and then abandon the hindrances and become enlightened. That's why, as I think you all know, this place, as I designed it, and I fought hard to make sure we have en suites in each room. They said, we can't afford that. I think no other retreat centre in the world had sort of en suites in each room, but I insisted to make it comfortable for you. And I was not indulging you. It was to make the meditation possible. And I meant that, yeah. Okay. And eventually, of course, it works for everybody. That middle way. We always tend to lean towards asceticism and austerity. Anyway. So, it's not complacency. This is the wise middle way. You do need to rest. You try going without sleep and see what that does to your meditation. If you try it, sometimes you don't need sleep. As I mentioned, the restlessness, less restness. And that is not because you decide to do that as some sort of austerity. It's just you don't feel like sleeping. If you get some meditation really flowing and you get these nice jhanas, you don't need to go to bed. You just carry on meditating, you feel fine. It's just natural. Anyway, it's always exciting as a monk reading questions. I don't know what the next question is. Please elaborate on luck. Is there a thing as luck? Isn't everything due to karma, cause and conditions? Can't help but wonder if, due to your past, that there was a team of Devas around protecting you in the near motorcycle crash. Einstein also says God doesn't play with dice. But luck. What I prefer is, because I was a theoretical physicist and mathematician, chaos theory. In other words, this universe is just so... the causes are just so fine. A slight cause. Remember that saying, that a butterfly flaps its wings over Tokyo and there's a storm over New York. And there's a lot of truth to that. A slight change and there's a lot of difference. You don't need like a big change to make a big difference. Even small changes can make huge differences. And so it's not like luck. It's just the uncertainty of the cause and effect makes a future unpredictable. You don't call it luck. And just a way of looking. If a person wins the lottery, yeah, they think it's luck. But of course, any mathematician knows it's just someone has to win the lottery. One person, looking on the small scale, it looks like luck. On a big scale, it is cause and effect. The next question. I wonder what this one is going to be. Given that Dharma talks are now readily available, we may take them for granted. Yeah? How should we listen to a Dharma talk? Relax, focus, making mental notes. Thank you. Listen to a Dharma talk with respect. It depends who it's coming from. This is a Dharma talk from, you know, from 49 years of being a monk, about 55 years of meditating. So you listen to them, but you don't try and take notes. You just soak them in. And it's weird that some of the things which you soak in that you can't understand, but they're stored there somewhere inside of you. Many of those Ajahn Chah similes, I never understood them at first. I thought they were crazy. Just like this simile, I haven't mentioned it yet, about Ajahn Chah saying that his monastery was a mango orchard. Have I said that in this series of talks yet? Okay, and many others I've said this. He said, Wat Bapong in northeast Thailand is a mango orchard where the mango trees were planted by the Buddha himself. And straight away I thought, now come on, it's not a mango orchard here, it's just like a forest, you know, a remnant part of the rainforest which covered the whole of northeast Thailand. And he said, those were planted by the Buddha. Planted by the Buddha? That can't be right. I know many countries like to think that the Buddha visited them. And even recently, when I was in Sri Lanka, one of the last talks which I gave, you know, for, was it 5,500 people, that the questions came up, and the question was translated as, some monks in Sri Lanka claim that the Buddha was born in Sri Lanka. What's your opinion on that, Ajahn Brahm? And straight away I replied, well, everybody knows that the Buddha was born in Australia. And even the monk translating, Venerable Dhammata, he was laughing his head off. Great answer. I mean, you ask a silly question, you get a stupid answer. So, the Buddha never visited northeast Thailand. He never sort of planted... planting mango trees. What would be a Buddha doing planting mango trees? Anyway, a silly simile. But then Ajahn Chah went on, they're all now ripe, all those mangoes on the trees planted by the Buddha. And they're so sweet and juicy. But you can't reach those mangoes. You throw a stick up and you never hit one of those mangoes. You shake the tree, it won't come down. You climb up that tree, you'll never be able to reach the mangoes. There's no way to reach those mangoes. The only way to get a mango from the trees planted by the Buddha, and this was the part which I always remember because it was brilliant. The only way to get any of those mangoes is to sit perfectly still under the mango tree. Hold out your hand and a mango will fall. Such is the compassion of the Buddha. That was idiotic. I've sat under mango trees before. They don't fall. If you're lucky enough to sit long enough that one falls, it won't fall in your hand, will it? Where would it fall? On your head, probably. It made no sense to me. I discarded it. I just remember that. I thought, I'm not remembering this one. It's silly. But years later, when you were meditating, wow, that was such a beautiful simile of how jhanas happen, how enlightenment happens. You sit under that mango tree, perfectly still. Open up your hand is that having the kindness, compassion, which is also important. And then these things, they drop into your hand. Surprise you. You don't do anything. You sit still. Those are the causes. And of course, these things drop into you. Anyway, But the interesting thing was, I remembered that. Didn't understand it at first, I discarded it, but it was such a powerful simile. It was recorded somewhere in my mind, and when it was needed, it came up. You thought, wow, what a great teacher that was. So much of the stuff which, you know, you hear here, if it really is worthwhile, you can't forget it. You think you forget it, but it's stored there somewhere, waiting for the time when your mind is ready enough to see it and watch it happen. Devachampram, when sitting, we follow the breath. When walking, we follow the feet. Is that normal loving? What else can we follow? Our normal beings. What else can we follow? Yeah, follow kindness. You know what kindness is? When you're just being eating, be kind to your body, be kind to your mind. Don't go too fast. What are the best acts of body, speech and mind we can do to help Ajahn Brahm now and in the future? Be quiet. You are beyond words, an amazing teacher. Well, why do you try and write words? So profoundly grateful for you and your teaching and kindness and compassion and your wisdom. It's not my wisdom, it's not my kindness. It was just brainwashed into me by Ajahn Chah. You know, that's a nice, interesting story. I've told many of the monks this. When I started teaching, there's only a few people used to come and listen. But then when I started going to Singapore, a lot of people started coming. And I remember you arranged a talk in Suntec City, in the big auditorium there. And it was, I think, the first talk I gave there, 2,000 or 3,000 people. That's a lot of people. And it was only just me giving the talk. There's no one else supporting me. Now, even these great acts like Justin Bieber or Taylor Swift, they always have supporting acts. I had nothing, just me getting up there and just, without any preparation, giving a talk. And all these people in Singapore, I think it was a weeknight or weekday, and they just come home early from work. I don't know if they'd even eaten any dinner yet. And they were all just sitting on the chairs waiting for me to entertain them or inspire them. And as I was walking in, I thought, oh my goodness, this is a bit too much. What if I say something wrong and they decide they don't want to be Buddhist anymore, they're not interested in meditation anymore? And I feel so guilty about that. Even worse, what if I really inspire them and then they ask me to come back the next day? And that's how I was thinking for a while. But then I thought, this is too dangerous for one's ego. And then I thought, hang on, I am not really giving the talk tonight. And I thought about it, and it was so accurate and true. It was all my teachers were giving the talk. The main person really giving the talk that night was Ajahn Chah. And the Buddha, and many of the other great teachers which I knew and had influenced me. When I said, I'm not giving the talk, this is Ajahn Chah's talk, it was much easier to give. I just went up there and just opened my mouth and talked. It wasn't Ajahn Brahm anymore. That made it much easier. I still do that today. What you're hearing is not Ajahn Brahm's teachings. If you look at it that way, it's more accurate and it means I can have fun. Don't worry about it. Ajahn Chah had a good sense of humour too. Oh, Ajahn Chah's stuff, he said he has a good sense of humour, very earthy. I was in a car with him. He was, there was a driver, a Thai lay person. He was sitting in the passenger seat up front. And in behind us was three Western monks. I don't know who they were, Atom Babakaro. He had this amazing gift for translation, American. And next to him was novice Gary and me. And Gary, he was actually lived a lot of his life in L.A. And, you know, he managed to sort of hang out with many of these film stars. So anyway, he was quite big and well-educated. And then all of a sudden, Ajahn Chah turned around and looked at Gary, the novice, and that's when he said, "You're thinking about your girlfriend back in L.A., aren't you?" And I was sitting next to Gary. His face went white. You've got to be very careful if you're sitting in a car with someone who can read minds. You better watch what you think. And it was true. And poor old Gary was busted and humiliated. And Ajahn Chah was very kind. And he said through the translator, which was Babakaro, he said, "It doesn't matter. If you just miss your girlfriend back in Los Angeles, we can help you." He said, "Do you write to her?" He said, "Yes." "Next time you write to her, ask her to send you something of hers, something personal. So when you miss her, you can always take it out, you know, something like a piece of her dress or a lock of her hair or like a photograph or something. You can pick it out. Ah, that's my girlfriend back in L.A. I was shocked. So was all the others. Is that allowable for... He's only a novice, but you know, is that allowable for someone in brown robes to do that? And I said, "Oh, yeah. And then Ajahn Chah said some more things in Thai to Babakaro. Then it took about 5 minutes to translate. He had to stop laughing, first of all. He said, and when it's translated, he said, "Yes, tell your girlfriend in L.A. to get a little bottle about this size and put some of her feces inside and send it to you. So every time you miss your girlfriend..." "Ah, that's my girlfriend." I was there when he said that. It was just hilarious. That's the sort of sense of humor he had. So if ever you're on a retreat and you miss your wife or your girlfriend or your husband, now you know how to solve that problem. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahm, does meditation train the mind? It appears to train the mind. But what do you mean training the mind? Does your mind need to be trained? Just your mind gets more peaceful and more smart. Care for the mind? Of course. Help us lose our mind? Yes. It's not yours anymore. Freeze the mind. But it's not the way that we lose your mind. You don't go crazy. You actually get wise for change. Many thanks for your insight and wisdom and jokes. Next question. Feel like changing the posture most of the time. What needs to be done? If you always feel like changing the posture, then it's just why? Try and get the most comfortable posture you can. And if it's okay to sit in chairs. You know, that's what we bought those chairs for. You know, we designed this meditation retreat center. I remember just going to these shops and looking at the chairs which they had, making sure that they were strong enough, had the right angle on the back, and they were tall enough. And for some people, first of all, we just got the ordinary chairs, but then we got some with the armrests. The armrests are not to put your arms on. That's just for people who have sloth and torpor, just leaning to the left to make sure you don't fall off. And we did say, but it hasn't happened. You haven't, like when you're nodding forward to actually have a seat belt so you don't fall off. We bought those. And if they're not good enough for you, try and get an armchair or something in your room and get it really comfortable for yourself, the most comfortable posture. But, you know, you never find it perfectly comfortable because it's a human body, but it's pretty good. And once you sit down, you're always comfortable at the beginning. But then, if you don't sort of get into the meditation, like getting into the breath awareness, or at least the awareness of peace, then your body always gets irritated. That's the nature of it. You look at the people in this room right now. How many are actually are still right now? You know, you're just moving your arm. You're just moving your head over there. Somebody scratches their cheek. Somebody moves their hand up and down. You all know I'm watching you now, so you're actually less moving. And you're wiping your nose. Why do we do that? We think that's normal and average. If you have a look how uncomfortable this body is, we always have to do something with it. Blinking your eyes, sniffing. Whatever it is, this body is obviously demanding your attention all the time. And if you get into a nice, reasonably comfy posture, then you find you can let the body just be. It doesn't disturb you. That's wonderful. When you get into some meditation, your body is just sitting there and it doesn't want anything in the world from you. You don't need to scratch. You don't need to move your arms around. You don't need to cover your legs with a blanket. You don't need to stroke your knees. You don't need to touch your nose. And that's amazing to notice, the insight that when your mind is peaceful, then the body can be still. It doesn't disturb you anymore. It's not like you're holding it still from willpower. It's naturally still. And you're comfortable. So you find a reasonably comfortable posture at the beginning, and then from there, allow the feeling of the posture to disappear. And okay, I'm going to say this. What is the best posture? Oh, I found it Sunday night.
Very good.
I don't know where they are.
I'm concerned for all of it.
Yeah, okay, no, don't need to be. So, that's wrong, it's Monday now, so I don't need to do them. With the posture, many people say this posture is much better than that posture. Which is the best posture to get into deep meditation with? It does not matter. And the story which, you know, proved it to me, sometimes you get these deep meditations when you least expect them. And this particular time was when, I think, first or second year as a monk in northeast Thailand, I had scrub typhus. It's like a typhoid. They didn't actually know what it was, but it was scrub typhus. When I had scrub typhus, I was just in the hospital for about 4 weeks. And just, you have no energy. I was young, only about 24 or something. I had zero energy. And just even get, and you don't have people helping you out, no nurses. There's only one male nurse, only from 6 a.m., I think, to 6 p.m. I remember the first night I was there, I had a drip in my arm, felt terrible, fever. And then the male nurse left. This was in the monk's ward. And then I asked the monk next to me, said, "When's he coming back?" And the monk next to me said, "He's not coming back. They only have a nurse on this ward during the daytime. At night time, if something happens, that's just bad karma." Have you ever been in a hospital, really sick, and there's no nurse, there's no way of calling anybody? That was that was what it was like. Accurate. Only other thing which happened there, which I don't mind me telling stories. I should be getting on to meditation, but the Thai people. I was only 23, 24. They're supposed to be really beautiful and petite and nice and kind. Now, maybe that's what young males think. But the nurse in the monk's ward, she looked more like a water buffalo than a young petite girl. And she had to be. And the reason was that they didn't know what I had. Only found out later it was scrub typhus. But they thought it could be anything. So they had a cocktail of antibiotics in the old type of syringes with a blood needle. I remember just having the COVID injections. You could hardly feel them. You know, even a mosquito hurts more than these modern needles. They're so sharp, and you only use them once. You don't recycle them. In those days, everything was recycled. And so these were really dull needles. So the nurse had to be tough, like a water buff, really strong, like built like a weightlifter. She never injected. Stabbed you. Once in the morning, once in the afternoon. Oh, my butt felt so sore. I was only a young monk, okay, so my loving kindness wasn't all that strong. No way in the world could I give her loving kindness. So I felt really terrible, nothing was working. And that was the time when Ajahn Chah came. And imagine, you feel so, so sick, so sore, nothing is working. And then your teacher comes just to see you. Oh, I was just so uplifted. And that's when he came up to my bedside and he said, Brahma Wangsa, I was expecting something to uplift me. And he said, you're either going to get better or you're going to die. And then he went. And the frustrating thing was, he was right. You can't argue with that. That's not what I really expected. So anyway, there's one afternoon, you just, you know, sometimes you get depressed, fed up. And so I thought, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? So I decided to meditate. I didn't sit up, I didn't have any energy to sit up. Just where I was laying, closed my eyes, and just started to let go. I knew about meditation, so I knew how to let go, and you managed to see your breath, became a delightful breath, and nimittas, the whole works. Blissing out with zero energy on my hospital bed. And when I came out of that meditation, you open your eyes, and it's amazing, the first thing I saw was my posture. And I'd looked at many books and went to many teachers, not just Theravada teachers, about how to meditate. I've never seen this posture described in any meditation manual. One leg was this way, another leg was that way, arms all over the place, goodness gracious. But then you can let go of the body. And it was that example, more than anything else, taught me your posture, as long as it's comfortable, as long as the body is happy there, the best it can do, that's good enough. All these people say you have to have one hand in the other and the thumb slightly touching to keep the circle of energy together. You have to keep a straight back, otherwise, again, the energy is not going to go up your back. You've got to sit this way or that way. That's total. The word is gomayang. I'm going to teach you some Pali now. Those of you who don't know this word, gomayang. Go means a ball. Mayang means the feces which come out of the backside of the ball. So, because I'm not supposed to say as a monk, bullshit. So these days I say go mayang, but it means the same thing, okay? So that you have to have this posture, not another posture. That's a little go mayang. So this is about the posture, as long as it's comfortable. That's why if you want to do the meditation on your bed, fine. But just make sure that when you lay down, it's not in a normal posture where you go to sleep. Because, you know, I realized that all these years, and especially if you do go in a hospital, you know, you can't sit up to meditate. So I learned just when I go to sleep, I always go to sleep on my right side, on my left side. I never go to sleep on my back, because that's a posture which I've reserved over 50 years for meditation. So when I lay on my back, it's like my brain knows he doesn't want me to go to sleep. That's my meditation posture, laying on my back. This is just how I've been trained over all these years. So find one posture where you can be comfortable, you know, laying on the bed, you know, stretched out, and you don't fall asleep. It's very helpful. Anyway, wonderful to see you again, Ajahn Brahm. While meditating, how do I manage anger arising in response to the experience of oppression? Who's oppressing you right now? Memories. Stand up to your memories. I will not be oppressed by my memories. I will oppress my memories. Memories, get out of here. Why do you allow memories to actually give you a hard time? They don't need to. You know, I just, when studying psychology or listening to psychology, I heard all this Go Mayang. But because this was a psychologist who had a degree, I kind of believed it. How do you let go of stuff from the past? No, the memories of oppression. This is how it's done. I taught this first at a conference of psychologists in Sydney. Being a monk, you know, you don't sort of teach what other people normally teach, so you're interesting, so they get all these invites to these conferences and stuff. So I said, this is how you let go of bad memories of the past. And I started the way that every psychologist would. First of all, you have to acknowledge them. Now, truthfully, bring them up. Admit them, what you did, what other people did to you. And the best way of doing that is to write it down on a piece of paper. But unfortunately, many people in today's world have got so many bad memories that an ordinary sheet of paper is not really big enough. But fortunately, there's another type of paper which is really cheap. And you can put so much on it. It's called the roll of toilet paper. How big is that roll of toilet paper? Imagine how much you can write on that. So get a roll of toilet paper, and to write it down, just an ordinary pen, it doesn't really make a good impression on there. So get a felt tip pen. Best colour is dark brown. So you write down all these things which people have done to you, your parents, your boss, your partner in life, the people you trusted, your favourite monk, whatever, I hope I'm not on there, what you've done. Write it down in brown ink. And you've got a whole world of toilet paper, you can write lots down there. And all this terrible stuff which has happened to you, write it down on toilet paper in brown ink. And once you've finished, what do you do with toilet paper with brown stuff on it? Do you ever fold it up and put it in your pocket? How much paper do you waste by not using it more fully? even Greta Thunberg, whatever her name was, she doesn't reuse the toilet paper. You just use it on one side, maybe half of it, and then she throws it away. Such a waste. So even a small bit of brown stuff on toilet paper, you want to put it in the loo straight away and get rid of it. So you read it all out, all this brown stuff on toilet paper, you read it, then you get the association, which is an important part of psychology. This is brown stuff on toilet paper. Obviously, what you should do with it, you go into the toilet cubicle and you do the ceremony, the letting go ceremony. You read it, and then you fold it up, bit by bit, not all at once, we don't want more toilets to be apparently in cottage number 10 the toilets are all blocked. Is that still the case? You haven't blocked it. Okay, so please don't do this evening in cottage number 10. I get into big trouble with Christina. She's supposed to be looking after this place, and I block all the toilets. But anyway, you read it, and then you put it in the toilet cubicle, and then you do the ceremony of letting go. You press the button, and it all gets flushed down into the septic tanks down there somewhere. All of your past, the bad memories. Why not? That's how you let go of the bad memories. But please don't do it in Jhana Grove. Please wait till you get home. Otherwise you won't be able to use the toilets anymore. Is it possible to enter Jhana during simple things, e.g. gardening or washing dishes? Not really, but sometimes, you know, if you are, say, washing dishes and you feel just the mind turning off from things, then you have to sit down. Because, you know, you're not conscious of your body when you're in the jhana. So you sit down somewhere, and maybe in the gardens outside, and you just bliss out. And somebody looks at you and they think they may be dead. Because even in a first jhana, you're hardly breathing. In the deeper jhanas, you don't breathe at all. So if that happens, a warning to you. If you know someone's a meditator and they're off in the bush here in Jhana Grove somewhere and you come up to them, they're sitting and they're not even breathing, just, you don't need to feel if they've got a pulse or not, because sometimes you don't even have a pulse. But just feel the temperature of their body. If they're still warm, they're still alive, they're in a deep meditation. If they're cold, then they're dead. That's the difference. There's this guy over here in Perth. You know, he's never had a jhana before. He just told his wife on Sunday afternoon, I'm just going to meditate in his bedroom. He went to meditate in his bedroom, and then just after about an hour, he hadn't come out. His wife was watching the TV, and his wife went into the bedroom and saw him. He wasn't breathing. It was really still. Never seen that before. So you know what she did? Rang the ambulance. Emergency. Sunday afternoon, they weren't busy. Ambulance came within 5 minutes. The medics rushed in. They took his temperature, heartbeat and pulse, breathing. They couldn't find any. So they put him into the stretcher and took him off to... That was into Charlie Gardner's hospital. He lived on that side of Perth. And the triage nurses couldn't find anything, so they put all these machines on him, and EEG, ECG were both flat. He was like dead. And his good luck or good fortune, the doctor on duty that afternoon in the emergency room, his parents came from India. And that basically saved a couple of lives. Because if they'd have taken him down to the morgue, which was what they would normally do, then when he came out of his meditation, there'd be two guards in the morgue, not the guards, two workers in the morgue would have probably had heart attacks. So the Indian sort of, you know, this looks like he's dead. What was he doing? His wife said he was meditating. Ah. Because, you know, you heard cases of people in India who suspend their life activities, you know, for hours and days. This doctor had always heard his parents talk about that but never seen it. So what the doctor did in those days was to put these defibrillators on the body, you know, the electric shocks. Many times he was having these electric shocks on his body, according to what his wife said. Nothing worked. And then eventually he just came out of his meditation. When he came out of his meditation, beep, beep, beep. The ECG and EEG worked perfectly. And he thought, what am I doing here? I was in my bedroom. What am I doing in the hospital? And all that time he was perfectly aware, but not of his body or the world outside. He was inside, blissing out, perfectly healthy. He didn't hear the ambulances. He didn't feel electric shocks on his body. His five senses had just shut down, and just his mind was active. And I remember asking him the question, was there anything unpleasant about that experience at all? And he said, yes. The only thing which was unpleasant, the scolding he got from his wife on the way home. It was, that's the only unpleasant thing. Never do that again, you almost scared me to death. And he was actually, they gave him a quick checkup, nothing wrong with him. So he actually walked home. He did. And that's amazing, those sorts of experiences. I love mentioning that. You're totally safe. But it's just what happens, as long as you're warm. That's what the doctor said. I remember his wife said that, that all the time his body was warm, which was weird. And that's exactly what it says in the suttas. That's the difference between somebody in a jhana and somebody who's dead. Anyway, confession. You like confessions? I am a repeat offender to JG, to Jhana Grove. Come here all the time. But every time I leave, there is this incredibly strange feeling of sadness, unlike the sadness of, say, leaving your family or loved ones. It only lasts a day, but it's very palpable. Is there such a phenomenon as spiritual sadness? I am investigating its roots. It's quite obvious that if you always get sad leaving a spiritual place like Jhana Grove, then don't leave. Become a monk or a nun. Why not? Being a monk or a nun is a beautiful life. Of course we don't. I should stop saying this because we never have any places for people to stay in Jhana Grove or Bodhinyana Monastery or even Dhammasara. Are there any spare huts in Dhammasara? There are. Usually there's not. So there's an opportunity for you. Grab them while you've still got a chance. Great, good evening, Ajahn. Yesterday you mentioned a devoted nun was almost about to get to jhanas, but she couldn't achieve it. How would one know? How would one know it? That person is closer to get jhana. Does that person feel it mentally and emotionally by action? I want to know if I am close to get it. Thank you. She had these beautiful nimittas, you know, which were clear, brilliant, bright, and had for long periods of time. He just couldn't get into them to where they would enter the jhanas. So he just had all the preparatory places, but just couldn't go that last step. When breathing gets fine and subtle, when it gets so tarnished as if I'm going to lose the breathing, a warm flow goes up towards the top of the head. I feel I'm going to faint. It has happened a few times. Every time I don't know what to do except coming out of meditation. Would you be able to provide some advice, guidance? Many thanks. The thing is, your breath is about to go. There's not enough joy yet, and you're still very much aware of your body. The idea, remember, like the breath is like a stepping stone. The five senses on one side of the river, just the pure mind states like nimittas and jhanas on the other side of the river. In the middle, the stepping stone is just the breath and delightful breath. If you can get onto the breath, it turns into a delightful breath, and that's very easy to step from there into nimittas and jhanas. It's a stepping stone in the middle of the river, but when you're in that stepping stone, don't go back into the body place. A person at this time should have no feeling of the body. So, and like a warm flow goes up towards the top of the head, you haven't got a clue where the top of your head is. The awareness of the head is gone. The awareness of the feet have gone. There's no bottom, there's no top, there's no middle left. That perception has disappeared from you. And that's the best thing. So you just got the breathing, and nothing else. Delightful breath. That's even the breath is vanishing now. So when the breath really vanishes, you should have no more lingering perceptions of your body. Then the energy just stays in the mind where it belongs. Ajahn, why it is always fall asleep while meditating, even though that or no, for normal activity, no sleepy at all? Do you think it is due to lack of sleep? Yes. But it's also the case that people get very sleepy when you're meditating or maybe during a talk. But then when you go to bed, you can't go to sleep. So what's the solution? The solution is the next time you come in here to meditate, bring your pillow and try to go to sleep and you'll be fully awake and you can meditate all night. And when you want to actually go to sleep tonight, just in your bed, just cross your legs and just start watching your breath and you fall asleep pretty quickly. A lot of time, I'll talk about sloth and torpor tomorrow. I really like your emphasis on not striving so hard. I can get quite confused as to when one should one watch the breath. Let the breath choose, the breath will come to you. You don't choose. Okay, now I'm going to watch the breath. You're just making peace, being kind, being gentle, doing that. Now is the most important time. The thing in front of you is the most important. And the only thing to do is to care. And then you do that, and after a while, just the breath is there. It comes to you. You don't choose to watch it. When the conditions are right, and you don't make those conditions happen, then the breath is there, nothing else. And there's one psychologist friend. I always like to have a laugh at the arguments with him. I don't mind people disagreeing, because that's when you can get things to go deeper and get your arguments a bit more tight. But then, you know, he always thought, no, you've got to watch your breath. In other words, choose to watch it and don't let it go. But after a while I convinced him and said, yeah, you know, it's true. When you just allow the breath to come to you, then it's much easier to watch. Because, you know, it's the right time it comes. And it's always so soft and peaceful. Can there be too many sitting meditations in a single day? No. Can this lead to dullness in later sessions? No. I recall one fact in Upaklesa Sutta saying excessive meditation on form. It's not sitting down, it's doing too much meditation on one thing and stopping the meditation just developing naturally. Just like you think, I've just got to watch the breath. And then loving nimittas come up, say, no, no, I can't lose the breath, I'm going to stay with the breath. And then brilliant nimittas come up, no, 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 I'm going to stay with the breath. That's not right. Ajahn, what did the Buddha say about Creator God? He said there ain't one. Cause and effect is what creates us. But you know, okay, maybe do this simile. This might help you, because not everybody understands that. So, there's one time when I was giving a talk at a conference here in Perth at UWA, University of Western Australia, on chaplaincy. And I was co-presenting with a Benedictine abbot, Abbot Placid from New Norcia. He passed away some years ago. And we'd have lots of conversations, and he said one of his core beliefs as a Catholic abbot of a Benedictine monastery was that everybody was searching for God. And I'm not arguing with him. I don't believe that. Or do I? Because then when I was asked at this conference question time. I love really difficult questions. And the question was from this gentleman called Father Frank Brennan, a Jesuit, one of the leading intellectuals in Australia. He was actually asked by one of the governments to head a committee to introduce a human rights addition to the Australian Constitution. So he's the sort of guy you don't tell jokes to. So he asked me, what's a Buddhist idea of God? and I could just do the normal, say, well, Buddhism don't believe in God. That doesn't take you anywhere. So instead I said, my friend over here, I respect him. He keeps on saying that everyone is searching for God. So let's like take that as a premise. What are you searching for? What do atheists search for? What do hard-nosed scientists search for? And then you got all these wonderful ideas of what you're really searching for, what you want is respect, kindness, freedom, freedom from pain, freedom from sickness, even like hope. You want love, the idea of what real love is, and just unconditional love and acceptance. What do you search for? Peace. I've got all these qualities. He said, well, look, if you said everyone is searching for God, and he's like Buddhist or atheist or whatever, then that must be what God is. Peace, respect, this beautiful compassion and love, gentleness, even like harmony. And I said all that, and you can take it further if you want. And I said, look, this is an answer which doesn't divide people. Even the Pope could agree on that. And also the most strongest atheist could agree on that. And let's leave it at that. Anyway, they like that. So when he said, okay, I like that answer, and I thought, phew. I didn't want to get in an argument with him. Next question, isn't Buddha leaving his family a bad karma? Of course not. It was a bad karma, it would have some bad result. Because the Buddha left his family, he became a Buddha. That can't be bad karma, can it? Sometimes people don't understand what good karma and bad karma is. If you left your family, yeah. But if you became fully enlightened, then okay, you're off the hook. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how does one actually put into practice the caring and kindness of our meditation object? This, once you know what kindness is independent of the object you put it on. That's why when we do loving kindness meditation, we start with, may all beings be happy and well. Now, all beings. And then it's just, if you want to take the loving kindness into the jhanas, then you kind of what I call disembody it, not all beings, you just know what loving kindness feels like. It's just like a thing in itself. And then you can spread it anywhere, to anyone. And I love telling this story because one of the protagonists is sitting in the corner over there. When I was coming back from blessing a house, the youth group in Nolamara, they were just getting ready. They'd done a little session together. They were going to go to the beach, you know, to enjoy each other's company and our fellowship. But they had a car and they couldn't open the boot of the car. And I was just walking up to the car and then they say, oh, here's Ajahn Brahm. He can fix the car for us. And so the driver of the car, please don't mind me telling you, it's Ronnie in the back over there. And you know, they had the key, but it wouldn't open the car. So Ajahn Brahm is here, he should be able to use his psychic powers to open the boot of the car. And then you asked me, Ronnie asked me, Ajahn Brahm, can you open the boot of the car? I've been trying for a long time, it won't open. And I said, well, you know, if I open the boot of the car, will you ordain as a bhikkhuni? That was the deal. So she agreed. I didn't think she thought I could do it. So I took the key. It was loving kindness, that's all. I just got my loving kindness and just shoved it into the keyhole along with the key and just turned it open straight away. And so a poor old body, her face dropped. So you have to be a bhikkhuni now. I did my part. But then one of the other members of the youth group just happened to be a lawyer. Always be careful of lawyers. And she came to Ronnie's defense and said, yes, she promised she would become a bhikkhuni, but she didn't say when. Got poor Ronnie off the hook. That's really funny. But the important thing is, you just get this loving kindness energy, and you can put it anywhere, even on machines, on sort of on floors or whatever. And it's amazing how it works. So once you have that, you can put it in your body and do some healing of stuff which, you know, is supposed to be sick or whatever. The mind is powerful. And that's actually how you turn this meditation of loving-kindness into jhanas. You just get the feeling of what that loving-kindness is, but you're not spreading it anywhere, you're just keeping it. And then it usually appears as, in your mind, as this beautiful golden limiter. And it's gorgeous. And if you know, you can't take your eyes off it, it's so beautiful. And then, of course, you stay with it, and that just brings you into the jhana. That's how it works. But it also shows you what this loving kindness is. You can put it on anything. You can open car doors which aren't supposed to be opened. Anyway, that's what we do with it. You know it's loving kindness because you can play around with it and it works. It heals things, relaxes things. Is it possible to go backwards in our meditation journey? Yeah, I've already told you how to do that. The backwards breath meditation, remember? Or if you're really, really sloth and torpor, do the walking meditation backwards. I've seen people do that. Be careful, because you have to know how many steps before you meet the wall. Otherwise, you'll sue me. And you can sue me if you like, because I've got no money, no resources, nothing to sue. Now, can you go backwards? I know what you really mean there. Say from long periods of not meditating, months, years, or from us overindulging the senses, that are too much YouTube to avoid the world samsara. The real answer is no. You can actually put it off, delay it, but you always come back to it. That's what I've found. Many people said, oh, you know, I've just been trying to ignore this, but I just can't. It's just... there's a sense of this meditation which is just too beautiful and pure and profound. You may just go off and be busy somewhere, but people always tend to come back. It's 8:40. Can I do another question or two? Or are you tired?
Yes.
Yes. You're tired?
No.
Okay, easy question. Where are those two bad bricks located in the monastery? They're in the monks' washrooms. So you can't go in there. The monk's going to toilet in there. You can go and see my cave, you know, because I get out of it sometimes. You can go and have a look inside. But the monk's washroom, that's a bit out off limits. You know, for many years, because, you know, once you knew that simile, and once, you know, you saw the good bricks in that wall, that it wasn't a big problem anymore, and I just forgot where they were. I remember afterwards, people asked that question, where are they? And I didn't know. Because they weren't a problem, they just disappeared from my consciousness. But then I went looking for them. That washroom was the first building we built. I could see them now. And that's where they are. I always thought that one day, I'm too lazy, to go and build a wall at the front with two deliberately badly laid bricks. So when you come here, you can say, I visited Ajahn Brahm's stupid wall. There's kind of a bit of dishonesty about that, so I haven't done that. As one does the body scan, at times, thoughts come in and interrupt the communication of the process, a continuation of the process. Is that normal? How do you overcome this so that you can do a full body scan and no interruption? You just make the body scan easier for you and just more enjoyable. To me, it's like surprising that I never thought I could be aware of my toes. What do you want to be aware of your toes for? But then after a while, I'm just doing it now, I can feel my toes. I know what they feel like. And it keeps them healthy. You do it with other parts of your body. It's amazing what you can be aware of in your body. And because I enjoy that, it's peaceful, it's health-giving, that's why I love doing it. You may have a thought, but the thought is not as powerful as the benefits of doing the body scan. If you enjoy something, you don't think. I always noticed that just before I became a monk, I used to like classical music. When I was young, I used to like Jimi Hendrix. But then after a while, when you were meditating more, you didn't like the noisy stuff. And I used to like Monteverdi. He was my favourite. And sometimes you could listen to that. And I kind of wondered, why did I enjoy that so much? One of the reasons why was that to be able to listen properly, you couldn't think. If you started thinking, you interrupted the flow of this amazing music. If you were in a concert, a classical concert, and you turned around to your friend and said, wow, that's nice, you'd be thrown out. You've disturbed the silence which is needed to fully appreciate that great music. I figured that's why I started preferring the type of music which never allowed you to think. Every moment was the beautiful notes of some part of the orchestra. Can you please show examples of how to practice Deva level or even Buddha level kindness? Thank you, Ajahn. You are such an incredible spiritual genius. Flattery gets you everywhere. Okay. The Deva level of kindness or Buddha level of kindness, just you start with the ordinary level of kindness, and you do that to like an ant. You may have an ant crawling in your room. Give this beautiful kindness and see what it does. If you have real kindness, it's not wanting anything. It's unconditional loving kindness. Not wanting anything in return. You just want to give this kindness to this little being. And see what it does. If it really is kindness, the little ant will do all sorts of amazing things for you. My back is initially nice and straight. As I meditate, it becomes bent and crooked without me knowing it. How do I overcome this? Don't overcome it. If you don't know what you're doing and it just becomes that naturally, it's often your back is needing to actually be bent to somehow heal something. I trust my body and my back. If my body wants to sort of move forward or become bent, let it happen. And what happens, it stays that way for a while, and then you don't do it. Your body straightens up all by itself. When those sorts of things happen, when they happened the first time, that really shocked me. You know, I was sitting there, bent over, and I never did it. The body straightened up all by itself. I was aware enough to see that. It was my body doing it. And I always trust my body to do things like that. It knows better than I do on what posture it needs. Okay, this is the last question, so I'll leave it till tomorrow. Because that's our tradition. Sadhu. Yes. So there's one question left. You don't have to separate it. We'll find it tomorrow. Have a wonderful evening. May you all become enlightened tonight. It's okay. If you become enlightened tonight, then you can have a sleep in the morning. And you can be served double breakfast. And if I confirm your enlightenment, you can have breakfast in bed tomorrow. Okay.